Thank you. Thanks very much, Julian. Thank you for your warm welcome here again to Alma. It's always a privilege to come and be part of the corporate worship of God's people around the country. And today the text, or there were several suggested texts given to me and a theme of a serving community. And I've chosen to focus on Mark chapter 10, and particularly Mark 10, verse 45. Does anybody here have a favorite Dr. Seuss book? Dr. Seuss, do you know who Dr. Seuss is? Yeah. Anybody remember any of Dr. Seuss's titles? None of them are available in the bookstore, on this book table. But anybody remember any of Fox and Socks? Yes, that's a classic. Any others? Pardon? The Lorax. Yes, that's right. Cat in the Hat. We're on a roll here now. Come on. Green Eggs and Ham. That's got to be my favorite. And any others? Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that one. Do you know the rest of it? And any others? Horton. Okay, yeah. All right. That's enough. What you haven't mentioned is one that is a very popular book. In fact, it is the fifth biggest seller in the history of the New York Times. And it's a very popular gift for graduates. And it's this one. Oh, the Places You'll Go. Anybody seen that one? Yeah. See, you read the book and here you are. Oh, the Places That You'll Go. Well, David Brooks, you may have seen this book. It came out about 2 years ago, I think, The Road to Character. And he refers to Dr. Seuss's book, Oh, the Places You'll Go. And he says this: the book is about a boy who is reminded that he has all these amazing talents and gifts and ultimate freedom to choose his life. You have brains in your head. You have feet in your shoes. You can steer yourself in any direction you choose. The boy is reminded that his life is about fulfilling his own desires. You're on your own, and you know what you know, and you are the guy who'll decide where to go. And David Brooks goes on, and he says, the challenges the boy faces in life are mostly external, and the life goals he pursues are external, success-driven life goals. Fame. You'll be famous can be, with the whole world watching you win on TV, says Dr. Seuss. And David Brooks goes on, the ultimate goal in his life is success, to have an impact on the external world. And will you succeed? Yes, you will indeed. 98.75% guaranteed. And Brooks says the main character in this success story is you. And that little word occurs 90 times in that small little Dr. Seuss book. It's all about you and where you can get to and what success you can have in life. And Brooks says, the meritocracy system wants you to be big about yourself, to puff yourself, to be completely sure of yourself, to believe that you deserve a lot and to get what you think you deserve, so long as it is good. The meritocracy wants you to assert and advertise yourself. It wants you to display and exaggerate your achievements. The achievement machine rewards you if you can demonstrate superiority. If with 1,000 little gestures, conversational types, and styles of dress, you can demonstrate that you are a bit smarter, hipper, more accomplished, sophisticated, famous, plugged in, and fashion forward than the people around you. It encourages narrowing. It encourages you to become a shrewd animal. That's very much the world that we live in. Dr. Seuss's little book, it's a fun book, but actually it's got a message that many people have bought into. And David Brooks is right. The achievement machine rewards you if you can demonstrate superiority. And don't think that this is absent from the church. It's very much alive in the church. And these words of Jesus to these disciples and to these guys, the sons of Zebedee, these guys, the Boanerges, as they're referred to earlier in Mark, the sons of thunder. They've got a lot to learn about this. And so maybe James and John, maybe they'd been reading a first century version of, oh, the places you'll go. And then they come to Jesus with their request in verse 37, let one of us sit at your right hand and the other at your left in your glory. And then not for the first time, Jesus, he has to bring not just James and John, but he brings the whole disciple community together. And he has to help them understand again, and this is one of the themes in Mark's gospel, the complete failure of the disciples to really get stuff. And Jesus is very patient, and he brings this teaching again and again to them, that actually, compared to the principles of the culture and society and world around them, the principles of the kingdom of God are completely upside down. This countercultural, upside down way of living has been a consistent theme in Jesus's teaching. So if you turn back to chapter 8, verse 35, whoever wants to save their life will lose it. And whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. Or chapter 9, verse 35. Anyone who wants to be first must be the very last and the servant of all. And you see this reversal as well in chapter 10, verse 21. Jesus says to this guy in that case, go sell everything you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. That's a very subversive, different way of looking at wealth. And now here in chapter 10, verse 43, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. So following Jesus means taking a radically different path and a different perspective on life. And in this upside down kingdom, greatness is measured in terms of service. That is not the way of the world. It is the way of Jesus. It is the way of the kingdom of God. One writer says this, comparing the way the world sees things and the way the kingdom sees things. Greatness in the world is determined by status, in the kingdom by function. In the world, greatness is shown by ruling, in the kingdom by serving. In the world's eyes, the greater those who can order others about. In the kingdom, they are those who endure hard times and injustice without complaining. How slow the church has been to learn the lesson. We are status-ridden. We talk in terms of promotion in the work and ministry of the church. Generally, and the writer here is an Anglican, generally clergy leave the menial tasks to others instead of sharing in the washing up. We love honorific titles like Right Reverend and Venerable, whereas Jesus came to be, and to be seen to be, the servant. Now, you don't have to be an Anglican to fall into that trap of the little superiority kind of games that people play within a church. It happens no matter what community we're in. In verse 45 here, chapter 10, for the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. This verse is perhaps it's most often used, I think, to teach substitutionary atonement through the sacrificial death of Jesus on the cross. And that's a totally legitimate way of looking at that verse and unpacking that verse. But it's not the main message here in Mark chapter 10. Jesus is teaching about Christian discipleship and leadership and what should be the hallmark of the Christian community. The message here is that we are called to follow Jesus in the way of the cross, and that's a way of humble, self-giving service. So if we're to be a serving community, Jesus is to be our model. He is the supreme example of true greatness in humble service. You will not find any example like Jesus in anywhere else in history, in any of the other
world religions. He is unique.
And I came across a poem some time ago by Lucy Shaw. Lucy Shaw was born in England, but she spent most of her life in North America. And this is an old collection of her poems. But she wrote one some time ago called "He Who Would Be Great Among You." And it has these words towards the end. But I'm going to read you the whole poem. And she refers to these sons of thunder, these sons of Boanerges, as earlier Jesus refers to them. But just listen to this. I think she gets the message across very well in this poem. "He who would be great among you. You whose birth broke all the social and biological rules. Son of the poor, who accepted the worship due a king. Child prodigy debating with the temple THDs. You were the kind who used a new math to multiply bread, fish, faith. You practiced a radical sociology, rehabilitated con men and call girls. You valued women and other minority groups. A GP, you specialized in heart transplants. Creator, healer, shepherd, innovator, storyteller, weather maker, botanist, alchemist, exorcist, iconoclast, seeker, seer, motive sifter. You were always beyond, always above us, ahead of your time and ours. And we would like to be like you. Bold as Boanerges, we hear ourselves demand. Admit us to your avant-garde. Grant us degree in all the liberal arts of heaven. Why are belligerents? Why does this whiff of fame and greatness smell so sweet? Why must we compete to be first? Have we forgotten how you took simply cool water and a towel for our feet? He who would be great." So if we are to be a serving community, Jesus has to be our model. And we need to pay attention then to Jesus' life. I've been struck recently by a very little verse in 1 John 1 verse 6 where John says, "Whoever claims to be in him must live as Jesus did." Must live as Jesus did. Jesus had a deep concern for people. He truly loved them. He esteemed them worthy of respect. He saw that every person was a bearer of the divine image. And he didn't just say that with his head as a passive intellectual like many of us do. He was outgoing and energetic in his serving love towards everyone. He had an amazing capacity for friendship. He was always alert to human need. And of the 64 recorded instances of his contact with individuals, you never find Jesus sending anyone away without giving them his personal attention and getting to the heart of their need and their spiritual condition. Jesus had this capacity for people, and he didn't mind if people interrupted his schedule. So often we're very fixed and focused, and we have things to do, we have a schedule to keep, we have activities to run, and please don't interrupt me when I'm in my flow. When somebody comes along with a question, an issue, a problem, I was struck by what Ryan said about just opening their lives to people. I'm sure you've got lots of interruptions in your lives if you're willing for that kind of interaction and being accessible to people. But this is what you find in Jesus. You find this capacity for friendship, connection with people, because he was accessible. He was open to being interrupted all sorts of times by all sorts of people. But he spent time. He got to understand the need. He spoke into it. He acted into it. So this servanthood is to be embodied corporately in the church community. You see it there in Mark 10. Jesus, he speaks to a community of disciples. And he's saying, this is how you're to live. The true character of the church's mission is about serving and sacrifice, and increasingly in today's world, suffering as well. But I wonder, is that how you see the church community? Do you see the church as a place where you have opportunity to together serve, together sacrifice, and together suffer? One of the commentators on Mark's Gospel, Ben Witherington, he says this, some are all too ready to wear the cross, but not to bear the cross. We often prefer a health and wealth gospel to one of suffering and service. We join churches because they meet our needs, not because they give us the most opportunity to serve and sacrifice for the gospel. Yet still, the cross beckons us to come and stand in its shadow. Whether we do so or not is the ultimate test of our discipleship. So self-giving service is to be the hallmark of the church community. Servanthood is to be demonstrated among Christians in the church community. But being a serving community, it's not just about what happens within these walls and amongst the gathered community like we have here this morning. Humble service is to be extended out to the world. And Jesus' words in Mark 10, verse 45, they are full of Old Testament background, and especially Isaiah 53, 11 to 12. Why don't you just turn to that? Because it's always helpful to read from the Old Testament as well. And Isaiah 53, verses 11 and 12, should ring some bells after having just thought about Mark 10, 45. Here Isaiah writes, and he's writing about the suffering servant. Isaiah 53, which we see fulfilled in the Lord Jesus Christ. Isaiah writes in verse 11, after he has suffered, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. By his knowledge, my righteous servant will justify many, and he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will give him a portion among the great, and he will divide the spoils with the strong, because he poured out his life unto death and was numbered with the transgressors. For he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. So, although, of course, Jesus, as the servant of the Lord, he had a unique, unrepeatable mission of pouring out his life unto death and was numbered with the transgressors, for he bore the sin of many. But just as the scope of the servant's saving mission would extend to the many, the peoples of the nations, so must the service of the servant's followers extend to the many, the peoples across the street and across the world, including those who may be even hostile to Christ, to his message and to his church. So sometimes we think, well, you know, we've got to serve one another and that's enough. But no, we've got to look imaginatively at how we can serve the community out here, how we can serve the nations big time. How can we be the servants of the servant king out there in the world? Paul, when he writes to the churches in his letters, he talks about this, and especially about serving the people, the very people who make life difficult for you. So he writes to the Romans and he says in chapter 12, do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. To the Galatians, he writes in chapter 6, therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all people, especially to those who belong to the family of believers. Some Christians, they take the last bit of that verse and major on it, especially to those who belong to the family of believers. And they forget that Paul has said, let's do good to all people. In his first letter to the Thessalonians, to a community that was facing persecution, he says, may the Lord make your love increase and overflow for each other and for everyone else. And later on in the same letter in chapter 5, make sure that nobody pays back wrong for wrong, but always strive to do what is good for each other and for everyone else, including the very people who are making life difficult and persecuting you. So we need to kind of put ourselves back into the first century to get the full impact of this, because this was truly radical stuff for the first century Greco-Roman world. Doing this kind of thing was not the norm. This kind of service was incredibly radical. There were plenty of people in the Greco-Roman world who were motivated by concepts of service for the worthy few. So if you are worthy, if you are one of the worthy few, then you may receive my service. That's a totally different way of looking at stuff from where Jesus is coming from. The scope of Jesus' service was as broad as human need. It wasn't confined to the worthy few. And this kind of loving, sacrificial service, it marked the life of the early church and was one of the key factors in its amazing growth. Just to begin with, if you think about how Christians loved one another, that in itself was a radical thing. And so Tertullian, he claimed, it is our care of the helpless, our practice of loving kindness, that brands us in the eyes of many of our opponents. Only look, they say, look how they love one another. Wouldn't it be lovely if people in the streets around here, wouldn't it be lovely if the city of Bristol began to look at church communities and say, have you noticed how those people love one another? Have you noticed the sacrificial service that goes on in those churches? There's something going on there. There is something about this following of Jesus. There's something about this good news that transforms people so that they're other-focused and helping one another. That's amazing. We don't see that in any other place. What's this all about? Why don't we go to the church and see? Wouldn't it be lovely if people were saying those sorts of things, asking questions because of the way we live and treat one another within the church community? That'd be brilliant, wouldn't it? But, you know, documenting the rise of Christianity in the early centuries, a man called Rodney Stark, who wrote a book called that, The Rise of Christianity, he describes how revolutionary it was in the early centuries of the church that Christian love and charity extended beyond the boundaries of family and tribe. That it was quite extraordinary in the eyes of outsiders that Christians extended care and love to Christians in other places beyond their own particular clan. But of course, it went beyond that too, because Christians were willing to serve anyone who was in need beyond the Christian community, including their enemies. So let me give you an example from that time of history. 3rd century North Africa, the city of Carthage. There was a great plague which followed an intense time of suffering or persecution for the Christian community there. The Christian community was a minority community in the city of Carthage in the 3rd century. And an epidemic broke out, a plague, and the city was filled with this. It was a very dangerous situation, and many wealthy pagans began fleeing the city. But the bishop of Carthage, a man called Cyprian, he gathered his church together and he preached from Matthew chapter 5, verse 43 to 48. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that? So he preached on this topic, these verses from Matthew 5, urging his congregation not to save their own skin, not even to seek the survival of the Christian community, but to love their enemies who had so recently been persecuting them. And here was an opportunity to show love to the community by staying in Carthage, staying in the city, and helping pagan and Christian alike. And Cyprian's biographer wrote this: "The people being assembled together, he first of all urges on them the benefits of mercy. Then he proceeds to add that there is nothing remarkable in cherishing merely our own people with the due attentions of love, and that one might become perfect who should do something more than heathen men or publicans, one who, overcoming evil with good and practicing a merciful kindness like that of God, should love his enemies as well. Thus the good was done to all men, not merely to the household of faith." And you know, the result of that third century dangerous act of self-giving service was that not only did the minority Christian community that didn't flee the city end up having a higher rate of survival than their pagan neighbors, but the pagans themselves were helped by Christians and became more open to a faith that had proved itself in the midst of the toughest of circumstances. People came to need to know Jesus in the midst of all that upheaval and mess through the sacrificial care of Christians who loved their enemies. That's revolutionary. Where do you find that in the world? And you know, that happens, and that has happened in many, many situations throughout church history. So this faith worked. It was seen to work in and through the lives of men and women who walked in the footsteps of their master and lived as Jesus lived. That is a serving community. And it's in the context, you see, of vulnerability and humility that the power of the gospel is so often demonstrated. We began earlier with that book, Dr. Seuss's Oh, the Places You Will Go. Well, if we guard against becoming preoccupied with our own security, status, and power, then the Lord will take us to some difficult and radical places as a church community. And this is what comes through in the words of the founder of the Iona community. I'm sure you've heard of the Iona community in Scotland. And the founder of that community challenges us about where we are going as church communities. Where are we willing to go to be communities of humble service? And this founder, he says this, and these quotes haven't come out really very well in the PowerPoint, but just listen to this very radical challenge to us as Christians. "I simply argue that the cross be raised again at the center of the marketplace as well as on the steeple of the church. I am recovering the claim that Jesus was not crucified in a cathedral between two candles, but on a cross between two thieves, on the town garbage heap, on a crossroads so cosmopolitan that they had to write his title in Hebrew and Latin and in Greek, at the kind of place where cynics talk smut and thieves curse and soldiers gamble, because that is where he died and that is what he died about. And that is where churchmen should be and what churchmen should be about." So today, I'm asking you today, what is your church about? What are you about? Are you about serving or being served? Are you about serving yourself, or are you energetic in serving others?
Is your service limited to church and Sundays? Or does your servant-heartedness extend to Monday and the marketplace and the office and the public square? Is your service narrowly to people like yourself? Or are you prepared to take risks, cross boundaries, use your imagination, and see where and among whom the Spirit might use your servant heart? You know better than I the answers to those questions, but I just want to say, oh, the places you'll go if you're the servant-hearted church of the crucified Jesus. Amen.